Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome to the second part of our three-headed mashup involving Pete, Ned and David doing different things in the special edition of Never Strays Far that frankly, editorially, doesn't really hang together. If you're confused, let this be a guide. Ned is about to get a guided tour round Paris with his friend Rob, who knows a lot about Jimi Hendrix and Napoleon. David is into day two of his commentator's seminar at the UCI headquarters in Aigle and is about to bump into Jens Vogt, among other people. And Pete, well, Pete is preparing to run 5 kilometres very, very fast indeed. Let's join him then. It's early morning on the Isle of Man.
Morning, campers. Morning,
morning, morning.
So today's the day. The 5 kilometre running race that I set myself as a little mini goal to keep me motivated through the cold January months. It's finally arrived. It's now 44 minutes past 5. Woke up at 5. No idea how it took me over 40 minutes to make and consume plain rice and an omelette, but it did. No, so I was trying to wake up. I'm going to make another coffee. Let my food digest. And then, yeah, start to get my things together. Everyone in the house, I was still asleep. All the kids. So it's lovely and peaceful and quiet. Might start doing this more often.
And that is the sound of Paris. Well, it's a cup of tea being poured, actually. It's not the sound of Paris. Paris has many sounds. That's one of them. There's a bit of hoovering going on in the background as well, which is another one of the Paris sounds. And to my left, one of the other Paris sounds, as I've discovered in the last 20 minutes, is my mate Rob, who I introduced you to in the last podcast, if you listened, when I was talking to David, and David said, I'm going to go to Switzerland for the thing that I said I would be in Switzerland with him doing the commentator's course. But I'm not. I'm in Paris with Rob, and Rob's just been telling me about the sad demise of Orange Deluxe, how it all came to an end, Rob. Yeah. Who were Orange Deluxe?
We was a band, four-piece band, formed out of the ashes of 5:30. My brother Paul, and then he got me on bass and Keith on the drums, and Cope, who used to be a cameraman, TV cameraman for The Hitman and Her. He turned up at rehearsal, and then we all went out and got a paralytic drunk, and then we liked him, so he joined. So yeah, that was how we got together.
We're talking early 90s here, and then Rob. This is like the fag end of Rob's career as Reading's. I gave you a slight disservice. I called you Reading's third choice goalkeeper, which is only partly true, isn't it? But, no.
Well, yeah, I started off as a second choice and then got worse. So, yeah.
Tell us about the online poll that you recently found at the Reading place.
Oh yeah, I found an online poll about Reading's worst ever goalkeeper, and I was disappointed to see that I wasn't top of that list, because Gary Westwood was top of that list, as listed as Reading's worst ever goalkeeper, which Gary, if you're out there, I think is very unfair. I thought he was actually quite good.
You may be a listener.
Yeah, maybe, you never know. And I was second choice behind Gary, and I couldn't get him out of the team. I wasn't good enough, so that makes me Reading's worst ever goalkeeper, as far as I'm concerned.
Excellent.
Throw my hat in the ring there.
Yeah. The other bit of biographical details that I managed to elicit in the last podcast, just introducing you, when David was saying, who's Rob? Mm-hmm. I said two things about you. One is you are probably one of the world's leading Napoleon experts.
And you don't even have to comment on that. I'm just saying, I'm declaring you as genuinely one of yeah. You know so much about Napoleon, and a lot of that we'll come on to talk about, because we're here in Paris, and that's why we're here in Paris. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I said is that you literally only wear Jimi Hendrix t-shirts.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Yeah. I do only wear Jimi Hendrix t-shirts.
Although, today you're wearing
a Jimi Hendrix t-shirt.
Jimmy's just there, he's got like sort of yellow trousers, as if he's had an incident. And he's got like he's purple, appropriately enough, from the waist up, with his guitar picked out in purple. And
a monitor on a stool.
Yeah,
it's classic. One of Band of Gypsies concerts on the 1st of February, 1st of January, yeah. 1970, which they recorded, and four shows over two nights.
So this kind of fact you're here for at this podcast. But we're here in Paris. We're here at the famous Hotel Alison. We've just been, I think, warmly greeted by Laure, who runs this place.
Very nice.
Yeah, and as soon as we checked in, she said, "I'll bring you a cup of tea." She said, "À l'anglaise." So we've got a cup of tea and a little bit of milk. And then we're popping off, as soon as we've necked this, to go and... I've split my trousers, which is unfortunate.
Especially with bright underwear, yeah.
I've got a rip in the backside of my jeans, but we haven't quite got time, and I haven't quite got the motivation to go and buy a new pair of jeans.
Like doing another rip on the other side and just making it look like a thing.
It might
rip it lots of different places, and that could work.
It could. Mm-hmm. We're in the heart of kind of like fashionable Paris as well, so like I don't really rate my chances of finding a cheap pair of jeans here. So we're just going to toot off and hope no one notices. And we're going off. We've just visited the Madeleine, which I've often been inside, but I've never noticed before. Mm-hmm. Mr. Napoleon.
Mr. Napoleon's up on the ceiling in there, yes.
Celebrating what and why?
Oh, the Concordat with the Pope in 1802, I think.
1802, even I know that, Rob.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, where he tried to... The revolution had kind of split all ties with the church, and one of the ways Napoleon got the French people on side was to reunify that relationship.
With Rome.
Yeah, with Rome, at least for a while, anyway. It all went horribly wrong later. To kidnap the Pope later on, but yeah, in the beginning it worked for him. Yeah.
And then we're going to go off in the drizzle, and we're going to walk past the Place de la Concorde. We're going to actually pass. I'll tell you about this when we get there. We're going to pass the absolutely critical series of sweeping left-handed and then right-handed corners that leads to the final few hundred meters of the Tour de France every year. It's where it finishes. Yeah, right outside the Hotel Crillon on the Place de la Concorde. We're going to walk past that, past the obelisk in the middle of the Place de la Concorde. We're going to walk over the bridge, past the Assemblée Nationale, and behind that we're going to Les Invalides. Where we have booked from 3 o'clock onwards to go and see the Musée de l'Armée and Napoleon's tomb. That's the plan. So here we are at the Place de la Concorde, just around the corner from the hotel. It's the weather, I have to say, beginning of February, is filthy, as you'd expect, so no big surprise there. But here, Rob, we have to put a bit of cycling content in this podcast,
okay,
right?
Why not?
So the race,
they
go around this loop around here.
Okay.
They come along, so there's the Louvre and the Jardin des Tuileries, and behind that the Louvre.
Right.
Yeah, I'm pointing away to the left here for the benefit of our audio subscribers. And to my right, ahead of us, is the obelisk in the middle of the Place de la Concorde. And then you can see the Eiffel Tower, the other side of the river.
Oh, yeah.
And then heading up where that line of trees are is the beginning of the Champs-Élysées.
Okay.
And they come rattling along outside. They pass through, there's a little tunnel underneath the Jardin des Tuileries. They come towards us down the Rue de Rivoli here, thundering along here, past this line of traffic, which has to, it's not there on race day. And then past that very ornate lamp, they come around that, that's like sweeping left-handed, then they have a right-handed turn onto the Champs-Élysées, and then they sprint for the line, like that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's, how fast are they going when they come
very
up
very fast, Rob.
Very fast.
Yeah.
So that road there, the Rue de Rivoli?
The Rue de Rivoli.
Yeah, that's named after Napoleon's victory over the Austrians at Rivoli in 1797.
1797?
1797.
So that's really early on in Napoleon's story.
Yeah, very early, yeah.
That's before he's declared himself emperor.
Yeah, he's just fighting as a general for the Directory in northern Italy at the time. He's fighting the Austrians.
Explain this to me. So, the French have got Genoa north, they've got the Ligurian coast.
Yeah, they go through the Alps. His plan there was, he was between the Ligurian Alps and the sea, so he's in that little stretch. He goes over
Which
the mountains.
Another cycling connection here. Yeah. That is the final 80 kilometres of Milan-San Remo every year. They come from Milan, they pass over the range of mountains that you're talking about, they drop down onto the coast, and then they head north to San Remo. Okay. One of the most iconic bike races of the year. But anyway, that's...
Wow. Well, Napoleon went the other way from the coast, over the mountains, fought the Piedmontese at Mondovi, beat them, divided them from the Austrians, who were their allies. So he beat first the Piedmontese, made a treaty with them, then turned east and fought the Austrians and drove them all the way back across northern Italy as far as Mantua. And then he had to besiege that place, and he was there for a while. And each Austrian attempt to come down and capture it, relieve it, he was able to fight off one after another. And one of the times he beat them decisively was at Rivoli, and that's what that road is named after.
Rivoli.
So piled everyone into the car. On the way to the race, our eldest is currently thrown up at home, so he's not coming. I've been for a little bit of a poo, but I can feel another one brewing, which isn't ideal. Apart from that, all good and ready to go. This used to be my local commute to work when I was a cyclist to meet the club run at the NSC and where the 5K race is. It's actually where I grew up racing my bike on a 800 metre concrete. It's not a track like a velodrome, it's just like a circuit. So bring back some good memories. Slightly apprehensive about the race. Haven't done anything for 2 days, so I've no idea how the legs are going to feel. But I've got all the kids to support me, haven't I, guys?
No.
No. Oh.
Albert.
Yes or no?
Yes or no?
And a yes no from Albert. Yeah.
Will you remember me in a week?
Yeah, you're my son.
Will you remember me in a month?
Yeah.
Will you remember me in a year?
Definitely. I'll always remember your Axel.
Knock.
Who's there?
Daddy, don't remember him.
You got me.
One.
Now that's enough fart noises, guys. Please. Alba, that's enough.
Welcome to the VAR system. So here is the truck where we have the commissaire VAR. He's here to support the commissaire's panel who is in the race. So we have two trucks. This one, which is a new one, built last year. And the other one. So the system has been introduced in 2018. Initially it was only to cover the three Grand Tours and the five monuments. And then it has been very appreciated for the commissaires and even for the teams with this tool. So we have developed a little bit this tool with more races, and we decided to create this new track. Now we are able to cover around 60 races per year, which is around 230 days during the season. So please come in. You will see.
Going into the VAR truck now.
You can sit if you wish, if you want to try.
Yes.
It's possible.
They go in and they go.
I'm now in a small white transit van.
So the commissaire is sitting here during the race, and thanks to the system, he can see everything that the TV producer can see.
Okay.
So he has the same images. Uh-huh. Here he can see all the images available during the race, and here he can control the images.
So motors, different motors,
exactly. So you have the race in live here, So the images are from the Lombardia from last year, the last race of the year, and they can follow the course like this in life, okay? And if they decide to select, I don't know, the moto number this 2 one, yeah. And the moto number 4, they can see here. Normally they can work with they work with 4 screen.
Yeah.
They like working like this, yeah. Okay? And they can decide to stop because this is something. They can do to rewind. They can zoom as well.
Okay, to see.
Vorig jaar ook gedaan.
That's pretty cool. That's that little white van that often sits next to us in commentary. It's like literally like a ice cream van, and inside it the VAR commissaire has access to everything that's being shot, and so he's got all the motorbike cameras, like helicopter cameras, everything, and then can pick which one he wants to see if he wants to go back. So yeah, it's pretty cool, to be honest with you. Different way to watch bike race, that's for sure. So there you go, that's the VAR truck. Nearly finished here. It's been quite a long 2 days, if I'm honest, but a lot of learning. Going to try and get Jens on our walk to lunch.
So we're just approaching St. Ninian's High School, which was my secondary school, which is about 200 metres after the start of the TT races. I'm going to jump out of the car, and yeah, it's roughly a K and a half to where the 5K race starts, so, and it's all pretty much downhill. So it'll act as a nice warm-up. For the record, I actually tweeted it a couple of weeks ago that I'm going to try and do 3:30 per K pace. Go for that, and if I blow up in the last K, then so be it. I've been able to do it in training for 3K, and so it's just about adding that extra 2K on at the end. Right, starting to get serious now. Just under a 3K warm up done. There's some local fast boys that have came out to play today, so it's going to be so important for me to not try and stay with them in the first 2K, otherwise I'll just burn all my hopes of doing any decent time, because I'm not fit enough, nowhere near fit enough to do what sort of pace they'll be doing, like low 15s probably. Just finished my warm-up at Starbucks. Dropped the kids off for the last time. Now I'm back at the car, going to pin the number on. Head over to the track, do a few accelerations, and get in the zone, baby. Right, that's warm-up officially done. You know what, these local events are just brilliant, aren't they? Everyone's gathering around the coffee van. Father-in-law's also in the same race, Rob Young.
He's going to beat you out there.
He's going to beat me, apparently. Old friends, new friends. It's a glorious, sunny winter's day on the Isle of Man. And yeah, what else would you want to be doing on a Saturday? So, I'm not making excuses, but I have got a bit of a chronic... Emmy, stop hitting the microphone. Glute injury going on. So I can feel it a little bit, but hopefully I'll be able to get through the run with no problems. What, Emerson? Yeah, you're right. It is recording. Look, it's just hiding. You'll probably do better than me, Axel. It is. It's in there.
I can't hear it.
Stop tapping it. That's because you haven't got headphones on. Yeah, I know, but I don't need to hear my own voice, do I? You gonna wish Daddy good luck? My kids are delightful.
That hotel there, I think it's the most expensive hotel in Paris, or one of them, the Hotel Crillon. Armstrong, when he won, in inverted commas, 7 Tours de France in a row.
Didn't he cheat?
Armstrong?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, oh, Robbie did, yeah. Did cheat. I think he's the only, well, he's not the only one, is he?
No.
But he used to book out the penthouse there, okay, yeah. And all his friends and family, his entourage, would like stand, they'd hang a big Texan flag or American flag at the front.
Did he use a dodgy credit card? I mean, obviously that would be in keeping.
Do you know what happened to him, by the way? He lost a lot of money when it all collapsed, and, you know. But he made it like he lost hundreds of millions, okay. Tens of millions.
Yeah.
But he made a lot of it back.
Yeah.
Because he, really, really early on in the story, some friend of his or some business associate of his told him to invest in a startup company.
Right.
And I think he invested something like $100,000
right.
in the startup company for a large amount of shares.
And what was it called?
Uber.
Oh, wow.
He just wins. Whichever way he turns, wins. Yeah. If you flick a coin with Lance Armstrong, it'll turn up his side, yeah. basically, every time. So in the distance there, we can see now, we'll be all right. We're stepping out. That's all right, there's a little green man. So we're stepping out now. To the right, there's the Elysee Palace. There's the beginning of the Champs-Élysées, you can see. And then... and then in the distance, that's where we're heading. We need to get a bit of a clip on, really, don't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go this way. Let's try this way.
Hey, Jens. How you doing?
So far, so good. Enjoying the trip to the UCI. Learned a few new things.
I know. So did I. What did you think of the VAR truck?
Don't do it, Jens. It's a rival podcast.
Thanks, Lloydie. That's just former pro cyclist being dicks. Yeah. What do you think of the VAR truck?
I think it's a good idea. Helps the commissaires to make a more precise decision because they can, you know, move it slow motion, fast motion, roll it backwards so they can see exactly what happens on the track or can verify a decision. So I think it gives more credibility to the decisions made.
What's been the best bit so far? We're just about to walk into the x-ray machine for mechanical cheating, but apart from that, what's been good?
Lots of information, and I like walking past these boxes where the riders here have their bikes. So there's countries like Suriname, you know, like Afghanistan. So it's great to see how they support the people less fortunate, you know, that they give these kids a chance to ride and maybe fulfill the dream of becoming an Olympian one day.
It's amazing. All right, we're starting this next presentation. I'm off.
Okay, so we made it across the river and we've arrived at the Les Invalides and the first port of call before we actually go into the Museum of the Army is to see Napoleon's tomb, which I and Rob, actually both of us have been here before, but a long, long, long time ago. And it's every bit as gobsmacking as I remember it. Built... So he died in 1821.
Yeah.
And it was built some 20 years later or something like that? Or
1840. They bought him, tried to bring him back under, was it Louis Philippe who brought him back? And then he was buried here. Yeah.
Same chap who finished off the Madeleine Church, in fact.
Possibly, yeah.
So just to sort of like describe it, it's this enormous casket made out of this dark brown marble, and it stands on a plinth made of some grey marble, and that in turn, and it must be like, what's that, 20 foot high, something like that, and around it is a great big inlaid laurel wreath in this circular kind of setting with these angels standing around it, and towering above it is that huge golden dome that you can see from miles away.
The names of the victories into the ground, you see the names of the victories in the ground here, pyramids, Varengo, Austerlitz, can't see, probably Jena.
So beginning with F.
Yeah, Jena, Friedland. And then probably Wagram on the other side.
Oh, Jena, there's one, Jena.
Yeah, that was 1806 when he beat the Prussians. Yeah. So it's all these different,
Marengo, what was it?
Marengo. Well, yeah, Marengo was in Italy just after he came over the Alps in 1800, around the back of the Austrians. And when they tried to escape back eastwards, he fought them at Marengo. Got away with it really, he got away with a victory. At first he lost and he was driven back 2 miles, and then Desaix, who had marched off with the division, came back to support him, and with that division they counter-attacked and destroyed the Austrians, and the next day they sued for an armistice. And
this was all building his reputation, that kind of propelled him eventually to power through the coup. And
he was already the first consul at that point. He was trying to get peace with Austria. They've been at war with Austria for a long time. That was one of the ways. They had an armistice for a short while. They tried to make peace, but peace didn't come out of that. It was later on when Moreau beat the Austrians again at Hohenlinden in December of 1800 that they then made peace. But interestingly, after the Battle of Marengo, you get he got his dinner was made, and that's where you get chicken Marengo comes from. I know, where his chef could only find a crayfish and a dodgy chicken and some eggs and concocted some food out of it, and that's where chicken Marengo comes from. That's why it's called chicken Marengo.
And I didn't get my trousers repaired, no, unlike Jimi Hendrix.
Yes, Jimmy, yeah.
He did Paris. Was this in Paris?
No, it was
the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, the Isle of Wight in 1970. He's doing Foxy Lady. He's done his splits thing with the guitar and split his trousers at the beginning. And so he's had to go back behind the amplifiers, still trying to play, and say, have I split my trousers? They're like, yeah, you have. He's gone back, played the second verse. And Noel Redding, had stopped being his bass player, but his mum had come to this show because she lived in Folkestone. And she was back around the back, and she sewed up his trousers. During the song, he walked back around behind the amplifiers and just let the guitar feed back and played some noodly
still
notes.
This crazy
playing, yeah, crazy noise. And then had his trousers sewn up, then went back out and finished the song.
Ooh, Foxy Lady.
Took in the song. That song is about 8 minutes long, because about 4 minutes of him, he's having his trousers sewn up.
So that's the kind of equivalent of, like, if your mum had come to Paris here.
Yeah.
I'm standing here with some ripped trousers, basically riffing in this pod. Yeah. But she'd be like crouched down in Napoleon's tomb, sewing up my trousers.
Yeah. Which is a quite startling, startling image, to be honest, because my mum's quite old now. It's difficult for her to get back up.
So we've just concluded the UCI commentator seminar, and I'm sitting with Peter van den Abiel, the UCI sports director. Peter, can you give us a bit of background on the motivation behind this?
Well, the first priority for us is to share our experiences, okay? So, and also, well, TV commentators have an extremely important role in cycling, right?
Thank you.
Yeah, no, but it's true. It's about the storytelling, and also there's nothing more annoying than when something is being told which is not correct, for instance. That's what we also try to do, and to be transparent, to give you all the feedback from A to Z. How is the VAR system working? How is the testing related to technological fraud working? How is, in general, the rules working as well? So at least you have that feedback. So then you can start on a very good start block, let's say. Yeah,
I mean, it does feel, obviously, I've been in the sport for so long, it does, the UCI feels very different now to what it was even relatively recently, especially the image of it. I mean, has that been a conscious effort from the UCI to really open up a bit more?
Absolutely. This has been a change of the years, year after year as well. And every president had a different mindset, but also a stronger mindset, president after president, and times evolve as well. So, I am here since 20 years now, so I witnessed quite a lot of changes, and it becomes always more professional, even the sport, the sport itself as well, but also for us as the administrators, for the commissaires as well. There's nothing compared to being a commissaire maybe only 6 years ago compared to now, because they have way more responsibilities as well.
And how do you see the situation? We're talking about road cycling, and the situation of road cycling at the moment with everything that's going on, because it seems UCI continues to progress, but we continue to have these splinters and different things going on.
Well, I think that's the difficult part of it, because, well, maybe it's also a utopia as well, that suddenly you would have all the people having the same mindset, because, well,
yeah,
that's already difficult, you know. On the other hand, while I can compare with other disciplines, I think there's a way forward for cycling, definitely for road cycling as well. On the other hand, well, yeah, it is so delicate, you have so many stakeholders involved, and it's good, the relations with all stakeholders now are extremely good, and that also, you know, it started during the COVID-19 pandemic, because before there were still frictions, and there will always be frictions, we don't have to be blunt, but, you know, during COVID-19 everybody realized, from wow, our sport is on hold. So what do we need to do? So there also we have a very alert and attentive president who said, okay, but we need to be ready. So Peter, we have to be ready. So we installed kind of, conference calls, video calls with the stakeholders. And that's how we started to recreate confidence and trust in between the stakeholders to relaunch the calendar, which was completely out of the box because Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, they were suddenly later in the year. So, but we all did it together, and that was a good stepping stone to where we are now in the discussions as well, because everybody sees a brighter future of road cycling in the future. On the other hand, you have, through the stakeholders, you have different right holders as well, and that makes it complicated, and that's something where we have to get through. But to give another example, with mountain bike or cyclocross, we have contracts with parties for the World Cup, because we have the exclusive rights of the UCI mountain bike or cyclocross World Cup, which we can transfer, sell, share, which is in road cycling not the case. And that is a very delicate matter, of course. Yeah?
Well, thank you very much, Peter. Now to lunch. I've learnt a lot. It's been a good couple of days. All right, thanks.
So we just stepped a few yards to the side, and one of these side chapels in this enormous church contains, well, there are sarcophagus, there are tombs to all sorts of important people, including, here's a Tour de France connection actually, Vauban, who is
fortress, famous for designing and building massive fortresses,
kind of star-shaped ones, and Belfort. So one of the things that the Tour de France does every single year is go close to Belfort, to the big fort there, and other ones in the Alps and in the Jura mountain range, I think. And invariably, every single year, you will see one or other of the Vauban fortifications in the Tour de France. It's just a kind of annual touchstone. Yeah. And we've come here to much more modern sarcophagus. And this is the sarcophagus of Marshal Foch, who, of course, was the commander of the French army when Germany surrendered in 1918. On the 11th of the 11th in 1918, and they met in that railway carriage outside Compiègne, which, of course, you will know, Rob, is the start of the famous one-day cobbled race, Paris-Roubaix, which happens every year. Actually, it doesn't start in Paris, it starts in Compiègne.
Paris?
It finishes in Roubaix. Yeah. Are you concentrating?
No, I wasn't paying attention. I was looking at this amazing frieze on this sarcophagus.
Marshal Foch, actually, and I wrote about it in 1923 a little bit, because when I was writing 1923, I looked forward to the end of the race. Obviously, the film in my book 1923 relates to stage four of the 1923 Tour de France. But when the race a couple of weeks later eventually reached Paris and Henri Pélissier was declared the winner, there is a reel of Pathé film that's very... it jumps around. It's not just about the Tour de France. It's the news of the day. And it has kind of 30 seconds of rather wobbly shots of Henri Pélissier being given his laurel wreath and his honours at the Parc des Princes, where the race ended in Paris. And then it cuts to another event that happened that day. And it happened just north of Paris in Villers-Cotterêts, where Prime Minister Poincaré, who's this bellicose prime minister who basically ordered the French and the Belgian forces to occupy the Ruhr Valley, which led to German hyperinflation, which led to Hitler, which led to the Second World War, and set in train that whole... This is a really significant year, 1923. But Poincaré and Marshal Foch are unveiling a... On the day the 1923 Tour de France finishes, they're unveiling a war memorial in Villers-Cotterêts, which is actually, historically, in many people's eyes, the home of the ordnance of Villers-Cotterêts in God knows when. I think it was the 12th century... was in many people's eyes the birth of the French nation, and it actually ordained the change from Latin being the official language of the French to French. Wow. So that's kind of where it all begins. And Foch himself was too young to fight just in the... Although, no, you know, he was enlisted but didn't actually fight, I think, in the Franco-Prussian War. And he was quite an old guy by the time the First World War actually came around. But and apparently he walked into the... He walked into the carriage to the surrendering German generals who'd been ordered there and kept them waiting for an hour or two, and then walked in and went, didn't refuse to speak, and they all stared at him thinking, what's all this about? And then his first words were, what do you think you're doing here?
Yeah, surrendering, hopefully.
I had a few teachers like that at schools. What do you think you're doing?
Yeah, I had a teacher like that, but Robert Lamplow took the door off, and when he came, he took the door off and put it back in the frame, and then when he came in, he opened the door, it fell on the floor. And it was a lot of what do you think you're doing that day.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, so while Pete prepares to rip up his 5K running race and David continues to chain himself to the altar of exercise, I'm going about trying to stay fit, healthy and happy in my own slightly more low-key way. Often this involves cycling across London to go to meetings or to see relatives and friends, but just as often it means going for an hour's run, well, jog, let's be honest, as I did 4 times in Madrid, just to keep lively and alert. It's a big part of my life and a massive part of my morning ritual, even when I'm on the move, is AG1. I always make sure I'm travelling with enough packs to last the trip because drinking the blend of whole food nutrients has become part of my day over the last few years. To be honest, I can feel a little bit lost if I forget them. In one glassful of AG1, there's just about the whole deal. Each and every aspect of staying healthy and well, given a helping hand by the combination of ingredients sourced and balanced to help with focus, energy, immune protection and healthy ageing. Something requiring a bit more urgent attention for me than for the other two. It's simple, effortless. Just mix in water and gobble it down. Once a day, every day. That's it. If you want to take ownership of your health, try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/neverstraysfar. That's drinkag1.com/neverstraysfar. Check it out.
Well, that's it. 2 days concluded at the ECI commentator seminar, the inaugural. I have taken copious notes for my colleagues Ned Bolton and Pete Kenya, and I've now got the ability to fill lots of dead time on air with really geeky stuff about VAR, about mechanical cheating, about the technical regulations, about the UCI calendar, and lots of other things that right now I can't think of. But anyway, it's been good. Glad I came. And that's me, David Miller, out.
Well, we finally exited the museum. Standing outside these Invalides now is the Paris sky, which has been drizzling off and on. Just the clouds are beginning to draw apart. Its temperature's dropped a bit and the sun's beginning to go down. So it's got that kind of inky blue sort of texture to it at the moment. And the lights have just come on in the Invalides and the golden dome is lit up. And to our right, the Eiffel Tower, which is all illuminated. The searchlight has literally just come on at 6 o'clock in the evening in February. And it's really quite stunning. And we've been essentially kicked out of the museum, and we must have done about a third of it, if that. What? Do you reckon about a third of the museum?
Oh, well, we did the Napoleonic bit, but we didn't
we had to rush it towards the end.
We did, yeah. We had to invade.
We were lingering over.
We had to invade Russia, come back, reform an entire army, beat the Prussians and Russians at Lutzen, Bautzen, fight our way almost to the Oder, get defeated at Leipzig, retreat back to France, fight the Allies as they invaded Champagne, get abdicate, go to Elba, come back from Elba, fight really quickly.
I want to pick you up on that because there was a Tour de France link to that. Okay. A few years ago, I was commentating on the Tour de France.
That really fast.
And a stage started near Antibes and went due north along a very straight line. And it was like the Tour de France organisers had actually planned it. And I think it must. When did that happen? When was Napoleon's big return?
March 1815.
Well, it wasn't the 25th. No, it wasn't the 2015 Tour de France. So, well, maybe it was.
Probably was. Time flies, you know. We're getting old.
I was commentating on anyway. But anyway, it was some sort of
for years.
You started commentating in 2016. I was reporting before then.
Well, maybe you were pretending.
I don't know. Yeah.
See, it's
but anyway, for whatever reason, the Tour de France had decided that was the year to follow the route to Napoleon.
Okay. Wow.
And so I read up a little bit about it in the few hours I had before actually starting to commentate. It was unbelievable, wasn't it?
It's crazy though. Yeah. No,
I do not know more than you know. Crazy. We've just spent 2 hours looking at buckles and muskets.
Yeah, muskets. I love them. Yeah.
And helmet bits that fit on the front of bearskin.
Yeah. Bearskin front plates. Yeah.
Bearskin front plates. We've been looking at man bags.
Man bags. The original man bag is, of course, the cartridge box, which was carried by all soldiers over their left shoulder, so the cartridge box would sit on their right hip so they could easily access the cartridges from inside it.
Incredibly ornate.
Yeah, some of them were very ornate. Cavalry officers would have these little equivalents, even though because they would carry pistols, so they would have a very small one, but it'd be very ornate and lots of gold trim and stuff like that to show how important they were.
Muskets that shoot round corners?
Yeah, that, or don't. Hence the way they're in a
bendy musket.
I actually did work them out. I'm not sure that's what they are. I think that might be some kind of...
It was literally bendy. It was a bendy...
Yeah, no, I
bendy
see that, but I think that was all the kind of the butt of the musket. I think that what you had on there was like a sort of weird mortar, so you could hold it around a corner and load it and fire it from standing around in safety. Right. But the actual part that fired was on the straight bit. Yeah. I did look a bit more carefully because I did laugh a lot.
I genuinely, Rob, it's insane how much you know. Like, you were just reeling off dates and names and what happened to these various generals and these marshals who all got ended up to a grisly end, and like,
some,
and some fellow in North Africa who said I didn't want to live beyond 30, so he didn't. And
no, that was General LaSalle. He died at Wagram, in Austria.
I was listening.
Yeah, he died in 1809.
But why? It's incredible. So I kind of like half jokingly said I think you're one of the world's experts, and I actually don't think I'm wrong. A lot of other people got bags of armies of researchers who've done this work for them. You could actually just sit down and write a book or three about Napoleon.
Yeah, I could try
off the top of your head.
Yeah, but it would be a bit factually incorrect off the top of my head. There's bits that, you know, but there's a lot in there.
Yeah.
And people say I know a lot about nothing and nothing about a lot, so I don't know which one it is.
How did you get into it?
Oh, well, I was very little, like not very old, like 4 or 5 or something like that. And my sister's boyfriend, he came around. I think he wanted to get me out of the way so they could snog. And he gave me a little matchbox with some toy soldiers in little tiny ones that he painted and gave them to me to keep me occupied while he was off.
To get you out of the room.
Yeah, so he could get me out of the way while he was snogging my sister. So,
and here we are.
And here we are. Yeah.
50 years later.
Yeah, standing outside the of Leeds, yeah. Yeah, so my sister's boyfriend at that time has a lot to answer for.
Do you know what I take from all that? I take from all that that I thought I knew, but I know it with a much greater depth of kind of understanding now, just from that brief visit, is that Napoleon's presence in French life is just immeasurable and to this day. And that although this is the Army Museum, so, you know, a lot of what we've just seen focuses on his military campaigns. Round his sepulchre, the friezes around his sepulchre, are a kind of homage to his civil legacy. So, like, his you know, kind of like laying down a French
law
and
between 1800 and 1804, before the wars all started again, he did a lot of the Code Napoleon. He reformed the banking system, the school system, the like public works, the church. We talked about that earlier on. So he did loads of stuff. And the Code Napoleon outlasted him by a long time. It's only the last 20 or 30 years or whatever that it's gone away completely. But that stuff he did was to rebuild France, to make it a viable nation, because it had had, you know, 10 years or whatever of revolution, counter-revolution and revolution and counter-revolution, just complete instability.
And the magic trick that he played was he was made consul in 1800. So 11 years after they got rid of the monarchy, he declares himself emperor and sits on a throne.
In 1804,
In 1803, he's literally dressed in ermine, sitting on a throne, going, suckers.
Yeah, my people, my family are going to inherit this. Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant.
So, he turned it all on its head. And you've got to remember that it's not just that, but 1793, he was a captain He wasn't a captain. He was in charge of 100 men. Yeah. And 11 years later...
He's emperor.
Emperor. Of all of France. And
right.
Italy.
And do you know what I'm going to suggest now? We're going to get a beer.
Yeah.
And then we're going to go. We're going to go to a beer. Mad cafe that, if it's interesting, I'll report back on. Okay. Hopefully, if it's open. And then we're going to... And tomorrow... We're going to link this back to cycling a little bit, because yeah, I'm going to take you up the route of the final stage of the Tour de France. Okay, yeah,
that'd be great. I was rubbish at cycling, you know, famously fell off all the time.
So we left Les Invalides after an amazing few hours with Rob guiding me through Napoleonic history, and we went into the 15th arrondissement, down to the old meatpacking quarters where the horse abattoirs used to be in the 19th century and into the 20th century as well, before eventually they were demolished. And there is a cafe there that I wanted to take Rob to. So unique and so extraordinary that I couldn't quite believe it existed. And it does exist. We went to the Cafe Wolczak, named after Janek Wolczak, who was of Polish origins, a French boxer of the post-war years, from 1944, I think, till 1949, a brief career, became French champion, put Sugar Ray Robinson on the canvas at one point, but went on to lose the match, and a European champion as well. He set up this cafe, this bistro, which is still there, and it's extraordinary. You have to knock on the door. You can't just walk in. You have to knock on the door and wait for them to answer. They're very selective about who they let in. And all on the walls, there are memorabilia of all the famous people who have been in this cafe. The family sold it a few years ago, the descendants, but it's still very much kept in its original state. And Georges Brassens, the famous chansonnier of the 1950s, was a big patron of this bistro. And he even wrote a song about it called Le Bistrot.
Dans un coin pourri du pauvre Paris, sur une place. L'est un vieux bistrot tenu par un gros dégueulasse. Si t'as le bec fin.
And his image is everywhere on the walls as well, often in the company of his protégé, Jacques Brel, who, of course, he went on to persuade to leave Brussels and come to Paris to start his career. So Brassens was a big patron of this place. And yeah, it was incredible. When we were there, it was just me and Rob, and the only other people there was a family celebrating Claude's 69th birthday. So he was there, his Russian wife, their son, Sergei, his daughter, so the grandkids were there, and some neighbours. And they brought out a beautiful cake that we all got up and sung happy birthday to Claude, and it was just one of those memorable Parisian evenings. And then we woke up in our hotel, and we made our way through the drizzle and the rain to a very, very windy Arc de Triomphe that we climbed the 200 steps to the top, something I'd never done before. And the breath at the top, the view at the top took my breath away.
Une espèce de fée, n'a vieux bouge à fée, hein?
What happens is, on the final stage, is we're switching to look over towards La Défense and the outlines of the skyscrapers there and the hills in the distance past the Bois de Boulogne, etc. The race will often start out to the west or down to the south or up to the northwest, 50, 60 kilometres away, and it will make its way to the river, and it'll rattle along the river, and at some point, coming from whatever direction, it'll hit the Champs-Élysées, and it'll do, I've explained those eight loops that it'll do. And it's the French Red Arrows, the Patrouille de l'Air, they will time their arrival, so when the peloton arrives, they will just come from the, what's that, the Rue de l'Armée, the Grande Armée. All the way over the Arc de Triomphe and down towards the Place de la Concorde at exactly the same time the peloton's coming up the other direction.
That must be truly something.
It's nuts, it's nuts.
It must be a bit distracting for the riders, something like, oh, look at that.
Well, it sets the pulse racing, it's absolutely,
Wow, and of course, away to the north, you've got Montmartre, which is where the Prussians and the Russians came in 1814.
1814.
Yeah, and attacked Paris from the north, and Mortier and Marmont defended it over there for the day. And then they made an agreement and withdrew south and through the city to the south and gave it up to the Allies. And that was really the end of Napoleon.
And then in 1840, his ashes
yeah.
Were brought back here in a ceremony, weren't they?
Yeah, they were.
Under the Arc de Triomphe.
I believe so, yeah. Yeah, in a big procession. And a very large, seeing that sarcophagus yesterday, a very large wagon with very many horses.
You can say that again. Go on, say it.
A very large wagon with very many horses.
Almost fainted after the finish, was in pure oxygen debt after about a K. Felt like I had asthma, even though I don't. I think I could hear my breathing from, I don't know, Birkenhead. But you don't. But I'm not having the timing. 17:29 or something, the official timing was. But on my, obviously because it's a circuit, on Strava, which will take as the official time because everything's on Strava, my average pace was 3:21 per K, which works out as a 16:45. So I really wanted to get a 16-minute, and I was a bit disappointed when it was over 17 minutes because, you know, I was constantly doing, I don't know, 3:20 Ks. So I'm going to take the time as 16 minutes. I won't be doing one of them for a very long.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Long time, potentially another year. You need at least 11 months to get over the pure pain of that.